This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show!
This episode of Best of the Rest is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible is the leading provider of audiobooks with over 200,000 titles to choose from. Go to nerdylegion.com/audible, sign up for a trial membership, and receive 2 free audiobooks. That's audible.com. Hi, this is Jay. Before we get started, I just wanted to take a brief moment to let you know that we had some technology problems during the course of this interview. And at about the 5 minute and 15 second mark, you'll notice a disjointed break in the conversation that could be confusing if you weren't aware of the reason behind that. So I just wanted to let you know that. Dennis and I hope you enjoy the interview. Thank you. Welcome to Best of the Rest, an indie comics podcast. This is Jay, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Dennis Chandler.
Hey, everybody.
And we are very pleased tonight to have David Pipoz and Jorge Santiago Jr., who are the creators of Spencer and Locke, a comic book that came out in 2017 as a 4-issue miniseries from Action Lab. Gentlemen, we are glad to have you with us. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Of course, thanks for having us.
And we're happy to be here.
There are so many comics that come out, it's hard to keep up with things. So I have to admit, I'm a late comer to Spencer and Locke. I just learned about it a few weeks ago. And
Now, Jay, I think Ronnie had been commenting about it to us like several months ago, but it was Ronnie, so we were ignoring him, and I guess we ignored him at our peril.
Well, maybe so, but anyway.
I'll have to give Ronnie the props.
Ronnie's great. He's been talking us up for a while, and you know, the guy's got good taste. What can I say?
He does, for the most part.
Well, he is from Missouri.
Hey, I'm from Missouri as well, actually. I grew up in St. Louis.
Hey, that's where I'm podcasting from tonight.
Oh,
go
nice.
Cards.
Nice.
3-game sweep of the Cubs.
Ooh, Rams.
Wait a second. You can watch the Rams now.
I can't after what they did to St. Louis. I've disowned them.
Sports chatter.
How would you expect it in your comic book podcast?
We're well known for going well off the rails here, so we just gotta start talking about something and let it go where it will. But
get us back on the rails, Jay. You're the father figure here.
Well, I wanted to have both of you kind of talk a little bit about how you started the concept of this book, what started it, how did you start your collaboration together, just sort of kind of the background.
Sure. Well, you know, a lot of it, I didn't really intend to write a comic at first. I kind of wrote it as a dare. To give you a little bit of background about me, when I graduated college, I interned at DC Comics. I'd say the better part of 9 months. The problem is I graduated when the recession hit, so there were like no jobs whatsoever. And, I kind of zigzagged around at different positions, but I also freelanced at newsarama.com. I worked in their review department, and I wound up becoming the reviews editor. So I kind of circled like the outskirts of the industry for the better part of 10 years. And, there was something like kind of in the back of my head that was like, maybe you should, you know, put your money where your mouth is if you talk such a big game about all these books. And so I thought maybe I'd write a comic that was kind of in the vein of classic Frank Miller. He was a writer who really had a big effect on me as a kid. That was the first writer whose voice really popped out at me. And I was at the time a really big fan of mashup music, things like Nine Inch Nails meets Call Me Maybe, you know, kind of two weird tastes. that wind up going really well together. And I thought, what if somebody did that for a comic? And so I thought, what would be like a weird thing to go with Frank Miller? And when I thought Calvin and Hobbes, that was like the light bulb kind of went off. I thought of this detective, you know, kind of beat up and like smiling maniacally in an alleyway, and he's holding a stuffed animal. And that's when the gears started turning, and I was thinking like, oh, like what must this guy's home life must have been like in order to still have a stuffed animal, an imaginary friend. And, that really got the gears turning. And then I was so lucky to be able to work with somebody like Jorge. I took a page out of Justin Jordan's playbook. When you saw The Strange Talent of Luther Strode, the first thing that you're really kind of struck by is how incredible that artwork is. And so I thought, oh, well, that's got to be that's the game plan. Like, you know, if you're a first-time writer, what's the best way to kind of get your name out there is you work with an artist who's way more talented than you. And so I went and looked through all the different art schools. I found Jorge's portfolio online, and I was just immediately struck by how fluid and versatile he was. You know, he had such a wonderful sense of energy and expressiveness to his characters. And I've been really fortunate to work with him on this book and our upcoming sequel, because I'm telling you, he knocks it out of the park every single time.
Yes, I would absolutely agree. I know, Jorge, you studied, I believe, at the Savannah College of Art and Design. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
Which I know that's one of the premier schools in the country for sequential art.
Yeah, it's one of the few... Because like my, I was bitten by the comic bug when I was 16, and
so I don't know where to pick up from. I know Jorge was talking about.
Yeah, I was talking about my origin story.
Okay.
I was but a lonely lad. My parents and I went out to go see a play. Oddly enough, it was themed about comics, but then. As we were leaving early, a man stopped in front of us, and I don't know where to go from here other than just straight up rip off Batman.
He said, "Have a very nice evening."
Yeah.
He waved.
Hey, that
for you.
That origin story's worked for 80 years, so
yeah.
If you can recycle it, that works.
No. 77 years. 77. Superman's older than Batman.
That's true.
You Batman, year. You Batman freak you.
So David, then you found. So you said you found Jorge by looking up through the different colleges.
Yeah. You know, just the different schools that kind of focus on sequential art, and I was really blown away. You know, just by I mean, Jorge was really. I mean, he's the full package. You know, he's able to really get fluid and dynamic movement, but he's also really about sort of these emotional beats. And, yeah, I mean, that's like exactly the kind of collaborator you want to work with on a project like this. You know, it's somebody who, he can nail the spectacle, but we both agree that it's the emotional beats that he really knocks out of the park. It's always those moments that I'm like, yeah, no, that's way better than anything I imagined. Like, go for it. Go through with it. So it's been so rewarding, just to be able to work with an artist like this, because like he is so just kind of on it. And I think we both come from, I mean, I kind of grew up on this very steady diet of superheroes and, you know, working at Newsarama, you focus a lot on sort of that mainstream. And, Jorge coming from this, the fact that he devoured all this manga and was able to incorporate that into his art style, I feel like it really kind of, it brings the best of both worlds together in a lot of ways, because I feel like I learned so much from him, just based on our back and forth. So I'm like, okay, like, how are we going to lay this page out? What about this? Oh yeah, hell yeah. Like, that's 100% better than what I was thinking. I mean, it's, He, I mean, I can't say enough good things about him.
So you gave him free rein with your script.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that we went back and forth a lot, because my background has been as an editor for so long. And if anything, that was kind of that was always my big struggle, was just to be like, okay, like, buddy, just like I don't need to micromanage. So we wound up actually, we talked a lot on every single stage of the way. And that way, I think it was able, you know, we're really able to get this kind of really the best of both of our visions out there. You know, I can't tell you how many moments in that book that Jorge really just kind of like knocked it out of the park. And we're working on our second volume right now. I gotta tell you, like, he's making volume one look like just table scraps. He's upped his game so much in the second volume, that I'm like, oh yeah, okay, cool, go ahead, that looks great. he's a joy to work with.
Yeah, that was one of the comments I've had was make about the, you know, the panel layout and how the book is designed, and it is richer and more, I think, well thought out than a lot of comic books I've seen.
Thank you, Abe.
Like I said, you know, it varies. You know, you have some pages are the kind of a traditional 9-panel page, and then you have a 6-panel. Then, you change the colors of the borders in certain areas. Like when you're telling the story of, the last flight of Rocketman Reynolds.
That's my favorite issue.
Yeah. That was crazy, crazy, crazy. But, you know, the panel borders are green. So, you know, it's easy to understand where you are in that book based on that. And I thought that was well.
Thank you. That panel border, choice that you're talking about. Actually, that was all our colorist, Jason Smith. I actually hadn't thought of that. I'm sometimes somewhat of a traditionalist. So I like the kind of white gutters with the black, background, or the black borders. And, Jason was like, hey, what if we tried it like this with a black gutter and, a collared border? And I was like, yeah, that's like kind of cool. Like that kind of sets up the vibe. So yeah, thank you, Jason. He's working on colors of, issue one of the new arc right now.
Yes. I was going to mention that Jason Smith did the colors because I find the colorist is, they are the unsung heroes of comic books in a lot of cases.
Definitely.
You know, they get the scriptwriter and the penciler seem to get all the attention, and man, the colorist is so important on certain things.
I agree. I mean, when I was at DC, that's something they really beat into me was how important colors were. And I don't know if I ever told you this, Jorge, but Jason was actually, he was not our first colorist. He was our third colorist. We had gone through a couple of colorists who I was just like, I can't show Jorge this artwork. It just doesn't, like, it's not ready for prime time. And I remember feeling kind of despondent about it. And, Taylor Esposito of Ghost Cliff Studios, he said, hey, I know a colorist, Jason Smith, you should hit him up. And, when putting Jorge and Jason in a room together, that's magic. When I saw those preview pages coming in, that's when I knew this book was like gonna take off. I hadn't said it to them at that time, but I said, you know, if nobody picks this up, maybe we'll Kickstarter this and do it. Like, I want to publish it out of spite. Because they're so good together. They really just, they play off each other so nicely. Sorry, I'm gonna geek out about color.
Well, you gotta give some love to the letterer also, because there's how many different fonts and how many different styles in the lettering in here?
Do we? I'm kidding. Colin Bell, I've known him longer than any member of the team. He actually used to write for me.
Is the call still going?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, the call's still going, Jorge.
Okay. Oh. Yeah, I guess David was talking and it sort of cut out, and I was like, wait, did I get booted out again?
And I gotta step back and let you talk, man. I'm sorry. I know I've been rambling a ton.
Well, that's the wonders of Skype, Jorge.
Okay.
I was just, Colin, I've known him since he was a freelancer for me at Newsarama. He was when the art came in, he was the first choice, I had. And I buff Colin's chops all the time, but it's purely out of love. You know, he puts up with a lot, because I tend to write a lot of dialogue, and he somehow manages to make it work. It's him, he and Jorge together really kind of rein in my worst impulses. So, thank you guys. I really appreciate it.
There's so much to talk about in this book. This book is so richly put together, and there's so many layers to it. You know, there's the overall story is Locke trying to solve the murder of this woman who's a childhood friend, Sophie. But we get so much more issue comes out. We find out more about Locke, and there's incredible amount of character development, especially on him. You know, learning that he has been physically and emotionally abused by his mother. His father is a underworld criminal. He was sexually abused by a babysitter, and all these things that have shaped him and made him the character he is, which I thought was, that became so fascinating to me to see what he's going through, that the actual finding out, solving the murder became, for me, a secondary part of the story.
Thank you. I'm glad you read it that way, because that's kind of how I wrote it as well. So the mystery, the plotting stuff I don't feel like I'm quite as strong at. But if you find some cool character stuff to work with, you can riff on that forever. And I'm glad you read it that way, because we had a few reviews say that, where they're like, well, you know, maybe the mystery wrapped up a little easy, but you know, the characters all wrapped up so nicely. And I was like, good, that was our goal. So thank you.
You're welcome. I didn't think the mystery was lightweight or wrapped up too. I thought it was well done. It just, to me, I look for the sort of the deeper parts of a story, you know, whatever's in there. And if there's good character development, that's got me hooked in immediately.
Thank you.
Yeah. One of the things I liked was how, you know, you had the different changes in art, and you kind of called back a little bit to Bill Watterson when you did the flashback to the past and everything. And I think that was a really good way to connect stuff. Was that, Jorge, how hard was that transition to go from the current timeline to switch to the art style to where Locke was remembering his past, or you were getting scenes from the past?
Okay. It was tricky. Like, so beautiful. I don't think I'll ever be that good. And like, I still feel that way. Like every time I do one of these sort of like throwbacks to the old like Watterson style, like I always, like I have to sort of get over the fact that like that this will never be as good as anything Watterson has done. Like his work was just so, it's so like atmospheric and simple, but like complicated and detailed at the same time. Like it's all these like contradictory things that all end up being, this is amazing. Like there are people who love that and don't really even think much about comics at all. But like even like it appeals to like so many people like worldwide. And so like doing my sort of like take on it was just like the whole time I just felt like, man, okay, I gotta do my best on this. But I had to sort of get over the fact that, it'll never be like as good as anything like Watterson can do. But like, I felt like those moments are so important to the context of the story, because, like one of the things in comics that I don't care for is when they have like a lot of, captions that sort of link people in, like 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago, like 10 minutes from now, like those kind of things. Whereas like, In our book, there's a very clear delineation of when there's a flashback. You don't have to, sort of like guess at, okay, am I looking at a scene that's taking place now? Or is this the scene that takes place when Locke is a kid and things are awful? Like, I feel that making those artistic choices so we don't have to rely on, over captioning things in order to create a context for a scene, I think that that's that, like, that's one of the best things that we could do.
Yeah, well, I just gotta say, when you were doing, like, the flashbacks to the youth, and these were the hard times, and you're pairing it with, like, Watterson's style of art, and I grew up with that, so I really love it and everything. It just made it that much more of a contrast, because you're taking those memories of of Calvin and Hobbes and this, you know, Sunday morning and all that, and you're putting it with these events that are happening in his childhood, and it just magnifies them, like, so much more.
Yeah. Well, like, in studying and going back and, like, looking through, like, I've got a good collection of these, like, recollected Calvin and Hobbes, graphic novels, but, like, a lot of those, like, I remember, like, everyone remembers, like, the really funny ones, but, like, there were parts in it where, like, it would be, I remember the one where, like, Calvin finds, like, a baby raccoon, and he tries to take care of it, and, like, it doesn't make it, and he's really heartbroken by it. Like, Calvin and Hobbes is a, like, it's one of those comics where, it also could make you feel like this is real life, or like, but it doesn't look, it doesn't look realistic, but it has this, just this charisma and this energy and this emotion to it that, like, every character feels real. You knew somebody who was like this at some point, or you could imagine knowing somebody like this. And so, like, being able to sort of, like, do our take on it, and, like, and yeah, and to, sort of take advantage of that contrast was really helpful. 'Cause, like, a lot of, like, every time people talk to me about Spencer and Locke, they always comment on the flashbacks as being, like, a real potent, aspect to, like, a lot of the scenes, like, especially because they are so dark in a lot of ways. So, like, and I'm one of those people, like, I really like contrast in that way, because the more, like, I've always endeavored to make a comic that will make people cry, because I like when I read a comic or when I watch a movie and at the end of it, like, I'm, like, tearing up, like, I live for that feeling. And so I want to make comics that have that same sort of that same sort of effect. And so, like, I think that, like, I like a tearjerker. And so I also like to use as many, not so much tricks, but, like, techniques as I can in order to elicit that.
And the other great thing, is that when I coming into Spencer and Locke, for me, I always kind of thought about expectations. People have a lot of memories and about the original Calvin and Hobbes, and how can we kind of take those memories and feelings and kind of subvert them and even weaponize them a little bit, which is why I think a lot about a lot about structure and a lot about, what's the best way you can go about doing something. And, our opening page, it took me a really long time to figure out, like, how do we do this? And then when the idea of doing a flashback at the beginning of every issue is sort of in that old Watterson style, people read it and they think, oh, what is this? Is it just bootleg Calvin and Hobbes? And then they see it and they're like, oh no, that's a roller coaster. I remember we had Jamal Igle, and Ray Anthony Height look at it, just before the book was announced, because they were both doing stuff with Action Lab. And, I'll never forget Ray looking at those pages, and he's looking at it, and he's like, no. And then he paced back and forth across the room. He's like, I can't believe you did that. I can't believe somebody did that. And I was like, cool. That's, like, the best possible reaction. I love sort of, putting people on a trip in that way.
Well, you definitely did that, especially with the title of the first issue, You Can't Go Home Again. And it's like, you're seeing that first page, and it's like, yes, Calvin and Hobbes. And it's like, oh, wow, that took a twist. Yep, you can't go back again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So masterfully played there.
Yeah, you talked about taking some of the original concepts of Calvin and Hobbes and subverting them. And, there was a thought that was done very well throughout there. you know, in some of it was humorous, like the one couple panels where they're driving and Locke kind of looks sideways out the car window and he sees the snowman that are all, you know, stabbed aside. So, you know, direct reference to Watterson there. But I thought the most, I thought the most inventive thing that you did in kind of was when, Locke is interrogating Stanley and he introduces him to Convict Ball. Because it's like, oh man, this is an extremely dark version of Calvin Ball. But,
yeah. You know, it was one of those things. I wrote the first issue kind of in one jag. After that, I kind of laid out the treatment for the other three issues. And I started with the treatment, I actually read through all of Calvin and Hobbes because I wanted to make sure there was no stone left unturned and there was no kind of wink and nod that, you know, I would miss. And, you know, it's funny for me. I mean, I'm really proud of what we did, and I'm really happy with a lot of the references we got in there. There are a few that I was really kind of kicking myself that we couldn't fit in. You know, I wanted desperately to fit in the killer bicycle, into our car chase in the second issue. And I couldn't make the action choreography make sense. Because, you know, if you have a kidnapped victim on the back of a motorcycle, you can't really like take out the motorcycle, without killing the victim, or killing the hostage. So, I'm very excited, you know, Jorge's churning through Arc 2 right now, and there's a lot of references we were able to fit in there, in the second arc that I'm like, okay, we're really digging in deep, with sort of the winks and nods and references, just because, you know, I mean, comic readers, we can be a little obsessive. You know, we're all about the Easter eggs. And I want to show people that, like, we're trying to think very deeply about this and just trying to get people to trust us also that we're not just doing this for shock value. We're not doing this for the lulls. We're trying to use these kind of bits of iconography, to explore a deeper theme.
Right.
So going on themes, I mean, at what point, I mean, did this come about and you realized it later, or did you, with full intent, mean to take the concept of the imaginary friend from, you know, just a childhood, you know, exercise to where it's almost like a mental coping capability, because that's how he's coping with life and what happened to him. And you never thought of the imaginary friend in that concept.
That was from the jump. My favorite movie is Memento. And I love that idea of somebody having a psychological issue, but being able to kind of flip it on its head and make it work for you. So like in the case of Memento, you have Leonard tattooing things on his body and writing all these notes. So when he forgets something after, you know, a minute or 10 minutes, he still has the marking on him. So he knows what's important and what isn't. And that was the same thing for Locke. I thought, you know, for a lot of people having, you know, you'd call him a schizophrenic, and being able to sort of take, his pain and his subsequent, pathologies, but being able to kind of play them against one another. He's able to sort of stick his head in the lion's mouth without it biting on him in a way. That really kind of appealed to me as a character. And it really kind of, I don't know. I mean, I love Locke. I love writing for him because in so many ways, he's such a sad character. You know, he's deeply broken in a lot of ways. And, but he always keeps fighting, to stand up and stay on top. And I don't know, it's very inspiring to me, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that's what's intriguing about it. And I guess I'll have to get on to Ronnie, because when he was describing it to me, it's like, it's a grown-up Calvin and Hobbes. And so I was thinking of it more of like, you know, somebody doing a riff on Watterson stuff, and it's just him growing up, and it's all the same jokes and everything. But this is 180 degrees from that, so.
Thank you.
So totally. So, Jorge, so you're working on volume two. Is there anything that you realized after getting through with volume one art-wise that you're gonna switch up or change up or surprise us with here in volume two?
Yes, it's going to be better. Like, I don't mean that. Well, it's cause like my, it's one of those things where I'm never happy with anything that I do. And so like, and for Spencer and Locke, like in the timetable that we finished it the first time around, we had a good chunk of months where the pages had all been done, but we were waiting for put into previews and then for people to actually get it in their hands. And so like by the time people got like their first issue, like those pages in my mind were already old. And so when I look at them, all I can see is just like the, oh, I really messed up that page, or, oh, look at his haircut. I hadn't figured out how to draw him yet. Like, oh, it's like, it's the stuff that, you know, at this point now, like I can draw a lock with my eyes closed. Please don't ask me to do it. It won't turn out well. But, like I know what these characters for the most part look like barring like the new characters that we're introducing. So like what I'm excited for is for people to see, art that I feel like is a little more worthy of people's time. Like I want people to enjoy the comic for sure, but what I hope, and I hope they take away from it, at least when they get to volume two, is like, whoa, he got a lot better between volumes. Like that's mainly what I'm hoping for.
And Jorge's leveled up so much. I'm biased because I'm probably his number one fan, but like honestly, like what he's doing right now, it is next level. And I'm already excited. I keep telling him about our last issue of the arc, because I'm like, oh, it's gonna be bonkers. It is like, he is just knocking all this out, and it's like, I mean, I feel bad because I feel like I put a lot of pressure on Jason, our colorist, because I'm like, you see these pages he's turning in? You have to match that. You have to be at least that good. I wish I could show you guys these pages, and our goal is to have an ash can of the first issue sometime soon, possibly for San Diego. And I can't wait for people to see it. It is just like unbelievably good.
What is the timing for the release of volume two?
I think realistically, you know, I think our timetable, you know, we're looking to finish the art, you know, sometime late summer, early fall. And then, you know, you add in, I think it's like 3 months in previews to that. So, you know, hopefully, either around the holidays of this year or the beginning of next year. You know, I tell people, like, you haven't, like, nobody else has seen the art but me. But when you see it, you'll know it's worth taking whatever time is necessary, because it is so good looking. But yes, I think, you know, we should have an ash can of the first issue soon for a con, San Diego or New York at the absolute latest. But I feel pretty confident that we can hit either the holidays or the beginning of 2019.
Oh, so hitting the holidays. I know that has nothing to do with the timeline in the comic. Does that mean we're going to have more snowmen, though?
Ooh, wait and see. I don't know.
That was my favorite thing from Calvin and Hobbes was the snowmen. I got one panel in this volume one.
I think you'll be pretty happy then with a section of arc two.
Very good.
I will say, like, going back to, trying to, like, level up and then make sure the book is better, this time, like, because we have so many people who love Volume 1, and, like, we want them to love Volume 2, but I already have to say that what I think what made Volume 2 fun for me and what made it, I think, like, people respond to it is just that it's definitely a book that's challenging, like, in not just in subject matter, but also in terms of, like whenever I get a script from David, I'm like, oh man, you're gonna ask me to draw that? Like, okay. Like, yeah, like I've mentioned this in like other things before, but like I had never drawn a car chase scene before. And then in issue two, we had a chase scene. I was like, okay. How am I gonna do
Isn't
this?
That incredible?
Well,
Isn't incredible to hear.
Yeah, I did my best. It was the same thing for like in issue three. I've never done like a sci-fi thing before. Like at least not like something that was a little more naturalistic. So like going this like sort of far flung like sci-fi was like a very sort of like, oh, okay. All right. How am I going to do? And it's already like that in volume two where David's giving me a lot of stuff to think about and a lot of stuff to go, okay, I've never drawn that before. Let's see how it goes. And, but I think so far, like the challenge is what makes it fun. And I think, and like, I hope that that translates to when people read it. Like, I hope that when they read it, they can tell that, oh, like this is a bunch of weirdos just having fun at their respective tables. And then the book comes out and it doesn't feel like we're phoning it in or anything, or we're just like, oh, we'll take the easy route.
And real talk, you know, a lot of that came from, I mean, part of it is the original Calvin Hobbes, you know, goes in so many different directions because ultimately that theme, you know, it's about imagination. But the realistic thing, it was, I thought, man, either this book people are going to love it, or I'm going to be in like comic book jail and never going to be able to write anything again. So I was like, well, what's as wide of a portfolio for the two of us as we can get? Because, God forbid, people turn on us. And that's what every morning that when the book came out, I was like, oh man, this is going to be the issue. They turn on us. And thankfully they didn't turn on us. But I said, oh man, I want as wide of a portfolio as possible in case, like, I never get to write a comic again. And that's why I was like, okay, car chase, great. Sci-fi, awesome. Dinosaurs, yeah, let's do it. And it was like sort of having like a birthday wish list. And Jorge just, he knocks it out. There's been no challenge that I have thrown at him that he has shirked away from. And in fact, the thing that I always find so funny when working with him, you've told me on many occasions, oh, if you want to throw me a 9-panel grid, that's totally fine. Don't throw me any more splash pages. and I think that it's so funny, and it speaks so highly of your work ethic. Because yeah, like you're like Jorge lets me, like, he gives me so much room to maneuver in terms of kind of these rhythmic tricks in terms of like throwing, like, you know, let's throw out another 9-panel grid. He's like, sounds good, let's do it. And it's amazing.
So, well, volume 2 is well underway. Have you got ideas already for volume 3?
Yes. I, you know, here's the thing I tell everybody I never want people to be asking what's for dinner when we're serving lunch. But, you know, I say, listen, you know, like, if people, you know, we want people to pre-order volume 2, we need, you know, as much help as we can get, in part just to make sure that Action Lab is, you know, feels like, okay, this is a worthwhile investment to do a third arc. I can say in the vaguest of generalities, our second arc really blows things up in a big way. It's all about escalation. From arc one, and it sets up Locke for a much bigger platform that we are then, you know, my goal is to deconstruct in our third arc. I said if you know, if people like The Dark Knight or if people liked Infinity War, I think they're really going to dig our second arc. Whereas I think our third arc, it's still big, but it's also, I like to say our first arc was kind of Locke's very personal, intimate psychodrama. And our second arc, it's not just him anymore. It's going to be played out over a much bigger playing field. It's going to sort of sprawl out all over the city. And that's going to have some, that's going to make some changes to the status quo that, you know, I'm hoping to pick up on for arc three.
Okay. Well, I was kind of being a little bit tongue in cheek when I was asking about, because I know it's way too early to be discussing.
It's early, but you know what? Even before I approached Jorge, I had ideas for three arcs in mind. And I think there is a bigger story for these characters. And if, you know, people's reactions for the first arc are any indication, I would need to see what their reactions are. Like, now I'm doing this for them now. It's not even for me.
Right. Exactly.
So you working, is either you or Jorge working on anything else besides Spencer and Locke, kind of branching out a bit or just to kind of create the creative juices, or is this what you're focusing on?
Well, this is my big focus, you know, because ultimately I want to make sure that I do right by Jorge and the rest of the team. There's certainly some other irons in the, that you know I've been developing, but you know for now, you know, Spencer and Locke, it's my first book, it's my baby, and it's a never say never kind of thing, I'm excited to see what the future holds.
For as far as me, like right now, Spencer and Locke is the only thing I can feasibly like take care of. Cause like I do have like comics that I've self-published, and I've been self-publishing since I was like 18. So like I've got other projects, but they're more like my personal stuff, but like I'm putting those on hiatus for the moment just because, while as much as I enjoy working on those, and like I do like 100%, every time I go to a convention, people are asking about Spencer and Locke. And so I can't conscionably no, I'm not going to work, especially like, cause like David's already written all of it. And like, it feels like, okay, everyone's counting on me. All right. I gotta get this through so I can make sure that everyone gets like the comic that they want to read. Like, so it feels, like before where we were, making a comic that was just like, oh, like let's make the best, album we can, kind of like in a, like a musical thing. Now it's like, oh, well now we have people who want to, we have an audience. And so there's like a, yeah, like we, like there's a certain responsibility, I think, to like make something that, like to continue to challenge what we're doing, but also to make sure that like our readers are thoroughly entertained. Cause like, yeah, that's what we want to do with our comics, is make something that people can read and then, and fall in love with and like, and find and, continue to read, like reread it and get like new levels of stuff that they didn't see the first time. And so, for the moment, like Spencer and Locke is like my main project. I don't really have anything else that I could do like in this time.
And, you know, to sound really crass, I mean, because I feel like Spencer and Locke Volume 1 really blew up beyond even what I was hoping. And I feel like I was the one on the team who was like, guys, like this is going to be huge. You know, ultimately, you know, for me, it's like I feel like the goal that I want to do with our team is, you know, I want to do three volumes in a hardcover. I think that there is, you know, obviously like you never want to overstay your welcome, but, it's been so heartening to just see fans. I did two signings for Free Comic Book Day weekend. And, I was at the Comic Bug in Manhattan Beach in Culver City. You know, they've been my local shop. They've been a big supporter of us. And I remember two high schoolers, I think they were in high school or in college, they walked up to me and they said, oh, we bought the book last year. And they were like fangirling about the book. And that just made my day. I was like, I'm sorry we don't have anything else for you yet, but it's coming. And just seeing how excited our fans are over a book like this, that inspires me. That sort of, just like Jorge is saying, we have an audience now. And I feel like we owe it to them to, you know, take them on more of these kind of emotional journeys. And these characters are just so primed for it. So, I mean, I've been saying this all night, but I'm so excited, to be working on a book like this with a team like this. Because really this is like the A team. You know, I'm working with sort of the best of the best. And, I'm excited to keep them around as long as they can.
I'm totally Mr. T.
But well, I agree. I think it's absolutely a champagne moment either for this creative team that got together, because everything seems to work so well. And I mean, I think you can tell when you read a comic and there's the creators are not quite meshed, they're not in sync, but everything seems to flow very well on this. It's phenomenal.
And how well, I mean, how good has it been working with Action Lab?
Yeah, they've been great. You know, I feel like there are a lot of publishers out there. Well, I know for a fact there are a lot of publishers out there that would never print a book like this. I'll say that a top five publisher, I won't name names, a top five publisher looked at our pitch, and said it was the best pitch that they would never publish. And I get it. You know, some of it is political. Some of it is, you know, if you ever want to get reprints of the original Calvin and Hobbes, you might not want to do a black comedy parody version of Calvin and Hobbes. You know, there are people who, you know, there are some people who just don't have the stones to print something like this. And the fact that Action Lab, I emailed Action Lab kind of on a lark. I'd heard about Princeless and Molly Danger and Stray and heard good things about all three of those. And I had emailed them while I was at work. I stayed after work one night to catch up with some paperwork, and they had Adobe Acrobat so I could work on the pitch document. I remember Dave DeWatch emailed us back about an hour after I sent an email in asking, how long do you think it would take to finish this book? And that's when I was like, oh, crap, we have to finish the book. We have an actual book. They, you know, Action Lab hasn't interfered at all. And that is a remarkable amount of restraint for a publisher in this day and age, where it's very easy to find who they want to sort of, they want to fiddle with the content. They want to kind of hold you back. And we're dealing with some combustible material just based on content. And if you have a publisher kind of trying to push you in one way or the other, you either are going to go way too far and you're going to alienate people, or you're going to kind of pull your punches and you're not going to be able to tell the story that you're trying to envision. And so really in that regard, Action Lab has been kind of a perfect partner in the fact that they've given us the latitude to tell the book the way we wanted to promote the book the way we wanted to pursue, opportunities in terms of multimedia the way we wanted to. You know, I think as far as a home base for our first book, you know, we did pretty well, I think.
Yes. I'm somewhat chagrined to admit this, but even though we do cover indie comics, Action Lab has not been a publisher I have looked at very closely, but I'm going to be changing that now that I've seen what they've done with you. I'm going to be looking at them closer. So.
Yes. And me also, I haven't done much with them and all that, and so now my previews, I'm gonna give them like a twice, thrice look over.
Thank you. I mean, it, you know, it's one of those things. I think that also helped us out in a big way. You know, it's a smaller publisher. There's not as many expectations, and there's not as many there's not as many inbuilt franchises to have to deal with. And so, you know, I think that makes it a little more egalitarian. You know, it's sort of, you know, you're not going to be stepping on somebody's toes if you promote your book, or you're not going to have to, you know, compete with an Eisner winner. You know, it's they're very much, you know, they let the content speak for itself. And, yeah, you know, when I work with a team like the one I'm working with, yeah, the content really does speak for itself.
Great. I think we're actually going to, you know, once this hits the airwaves and all that, I think we're actually going to work on Twitter, and we're going to give away 2 copies of the trade paperback to individuals out there that tweet the episode, and then we're going to get everybody that kind of tweets the episode and gets the word out about Spencer and Locke. We're going to throw them all in a hat, and we're going to send them, you know, give out 2 free copies of Spencer and Locke to 2 lucky tweeters.
You know, tell them if, you know, if the winners wind up being in the Los Angeles or Atlanta areas, you know, I'm sure either of us would be happy to sign those copies as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can, where can people find you on social media and everything like that, or out there, or kind of learn more online?
Well, the book itself has its own dedicated accounts as well on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. It's just Spencer and Locke. It's one word, and the "and" is spelled out. And then you can find me personally on Twitter. It's just Pepos D. It's my last name and first initial.
Yeah, you can find my I'm on most of the social media at Jorge Santiago Jr., all one word. I have to use the junior because apparently there's a Brazilian UFC fighter who his full name is not Jorge Santiago, but that's what he goes by. And so because of that, I have to use the junior. So,
okay.
I'm a little bitter about it. Like, I'm like, oh man, like every now and then I'll check my traffic and I'm like, whoa, I got a lot of hits in China or some other place. And then I'm like, oh, they're probably looking for the UFC guy. Dang.
No, we've never seen the two of you in the same place.
I don't know.
Your moonlighting is an MMA fighter.
It'd be sort of like a Nutty Professor thing, like I have to take a serum and then I bulk up into like this buff dude, and then I return to the weirdo with curly hair who draws comics at night. Like, although.
I smell our next book.
Yes, sounds like. Well, I know you mentioned San Diego and New York, but what are your guys' con schedule for the rest of the year? What cons are you going to be at?
So I'm going to be at Phoenix Comic Fest at the end of the month. I'll be doing Denver. I think that's the month after that. San Diego, the month after that. I'll be doing Baltimore. I think that's in August or September. And then, New York, I think that's in October. And then, yeah, I haven't quite figured out the rest of my travel schedule. Next time I'm in St. Louis, I'll probably do a signing, at one of the shops over there.
Well, you'll have to let me know about that one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fantasy shop, hosted me last time I was in town, and they were wonderful. And Star Clipper is also a fantastic, store. So, anytime I leave the state of California, I try to bring some copies of the book and try to do a signing at the local shop.
Now, I have to ask, so when you were doing your exercise and trying to figure out what you could mash up, do you remember any of the ones you considered but threw away?
Yeah, I thought about Sesame Street meets The Wire. I thought of a post-apocalyptic Sesame Street. There was a Sesame Street was like kind of the first one that popped into my head a lot.
For Sesame Street meets The Wire, please tell me that we were going to like keep them with the still like the big felt bodies and like the big noses.
Oh yeah, like, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Elmo was going to be like a runner, and Big Bird was going to be like the head of like the drug projects. Yeah, and then the problem is I just felt like that was like, that's like, oh, okay, you get like one or two jokes where you have, you know, Big Bird be like, hey, take a shot at the king, you best not miss.
what about Bert and Ernie?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Bert and Ernie, exactly. Like, you know, they could be cops or something.
I'm gonna work Ernie as like into a page now, because like I wanna see what that looks like. He's gonna be like a background character in a page of Spencer and Locke. So I like hiding Easter eggs throughout the book, and so that's gonna be one. Like, there's gonna be Ernie, like a Muppet looking guy, and like, yeah. see if you can find it somewhere in volume.
Listeners of the podcast should look for, in volume one, let's see, we've got references to The Room, volume one. We have, if you zoom in really closely, there's a couple of details where Jorge gave us stripper names. Let's see, what are some of the other Easter eggs that you threw in there that we should put the fans onto?
Because a lot of them are probably not even noticeable enough for people to get. Like for example, when I'll just give this one away because it's way too difficult. But when in the beginning of issue two, when Locke brings in like his bag with like the the beading implements, I think there's like a reference to Casey Jones. I think I put like CJ like sport bags or something on the.
What's a crumpet on the cricket bat?
That was my throwback to the 1990s Ninja Turtles movie, which I still like. I think is one of the like.
It's so good. Actually, I love that movie.
Yeah, it's like it holds up. Like it's weird. It's weird that like, oh, okay, this comic book movie from the 90s. Usually it's like, oh, Spawn. Yeah, no, but like that Ninja Turtles movie. Like oddly enough, like it's just real enough that it's got like a lot of heart to it. And also the Jim Henson's puppets, I think, make a big difference. Of course, it gets terrible in the second movie and then in the third one, like, oh, but yeah, I'm trying to think of like other, in issue four, there's a lot of, I'm trying to think of some of the ones that I like. There's a comedy band and I don't know. Is this like a, like an all ages podcast?
Oh, well, yeah, no, not really. We yeah, it's pretty much
adult. Okay.
Oh, we cuss on it all the time.
Okay. Well, it's not really cursing, but like there's a comedy like band called Ninja Sex Party, and like they're big dorks and they make like goofy music. And oddly enough, I was listening to a lot of their albums while I was working on issue four. And so, like, they have a song called, Rhinoceratops versus Super Puma, which is ridiculous. So, like, I think I put that in there somewhere, like, on a banner, like, oh, come see the skeleton of the Rhinoceratops, or something like that.
Yeah, like, that's
yeah, there's just a lot of, like, I don't know. They're Easter eggs to pretty much just me, which like makes them not even really Easter eggs. Like the reference to The Room, like that was just like a chuckle to myself. Like I'm like, and then David caught it. And I was like, oh, well, cool. So now two people.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah. Other than that, it's just like, it's just weird.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm just going to tell everybody to go back to their copies and start looking for the Easter eggs. Because anything's in play, apparently.
I should put together a list, I totally forgot the most like obvious one, like on our first like two page splash, like the graffiti on the wall. I wrote War Children because while I was drawing up that page, I was listening to the Rolling Stones, and so like that hook. Like just popped up into my head from Gimme Shelter and I was just like, oh, this is perfect. So I just scrawled it on the walls and like, yeah, I don't know. And of course that's the one I don't think of.
You made me look so good with that because somebody asked me in an interview, like, oh, what's the story with War Children? And so I had to be like, well, I didn't actually write that, but like this series is all about like children like looking for sort of shelter from like their own sort of, you know, violent upbringings and past, and it made us look very smart. So thank you, buddy.
Yeah.
Very good.
See, yeah, I'm looking through. I'm like, oh, like, what else did I hide through here?
Well, I got there, like, I think it was what in the issue 5 there. I was looking at them going into the Colosseum. That's where you got the interactive caveman exhibits, working tar pit, dead king T Rex, an actual good Marvel. And Rhino.
Yeah.
Rhino something. It's.
Yeah, I can be kind of salty with some of the stuff that I just throw in
here. I'm going to have to get a magnifying glass. My 56-year-old eyeballs can't read some of this stuff.
That's when you got to wait for the artist edition to come out, when it's printed on the actual size of how he drew it.
With your lips to action lab ears.
You know, people have asked about that. Like, I don't even know who to even talk to about that, but like whenever I've had a portfolio with my pages, like, people are always like, whoa, like, this looks great. Like, are they going to do one of those, like, image, like, gigantic books? And I'm like, I have no idea. It had never even crossed my mind that, like, my art would even be something that would warrant that kind of, like, you know, when you see, like, oh, look, it's Matteo Scalera's, like, and Rick Remender's Black Science in black and white, you're like, oh, of course, it's beautiful. But, like, I don't know, maybe Volume 2 would look good in that, but I don't know.
Let me put a bug in Action Labs here, because I thought something similar, and let me put a bug in there and see if we can figure something out.
I don't know. I just like some of those pages from the Rocket Man Reynolds sequence. There's some of those that I just they're just really nice.
Oh yeah,
that was like the issue. I mean, that was my favorite issue to write, and. You know, for those who haven't read the book yet, it's, Locke gets captured by, a drug cartel. And, they have an in-house doctor who is a chemist. And he goes, well, I'm going to try out a new cocktail on you, because, you know, when the authorities find a dead cop with this substance in their veins, your investigation is going to go bye-bye. And the problem is that Locke doesn't die. He instead hallucinates that he is his sci-fi alter ego from childhood, Rocket Man Reynolds. And he goes on basically a Tarantino killing spree while his heart rate sort of starts escalating, and sort of threatens his life. And, I just, you know, part of it was, like I said before, just being able to do something sci-fi, you know, it felt kind of a cool way to break up the story, but also just, you know, it kind of shows, you know, Locke is a guy who's kind of hanging on to sanity by his fingernails, and I wanted to show what happens when he slips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, there's that one, like that one splash page where, like, Locke is, like, sort of jumping between comic styles, like that. That one was a, like,
was if a doozy. We want,
yeah, I think that was probably the hardest page to draw, like, out of, like, the entire book. Just cause, like, it was a, like, literally a whirlwind of different art styles and different references, and, like, making sure that, like, each one was a, was like, it had its moment. There is an Easter egg there in, there's a lot of Easter eggs in that one, but, like, there's the one that's clearly, like, the 90s, like, sort of image riff, where, like, Locke is, like, gigantic and muscular.
Except the pads.
Yeah,
and
pouches.
The pouches.
Yeah, and, like, I put a rock in front of one of his feet, you know, like, there's just it's also, and then, like, I wrote, like, kids love chains, which, like, I remember watching, it was one of those, when, like, Stan Lee was interviewing, like, sort of the 90s, hit stars of Marvel, like Rob Liefeld and Todd McFarlane. And I remember Todd McFarlane was talking about character design, and he was like, yeah, make sure you got chains in there. Kids love chains. And I just, like, laughed at it, cause, like, it's silly, but it was true at the time. And so, like, when we had that chance to make, like, a sort of like a, oh, look, here's, like, 90s, Spencer and Locke, I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, this is how it would have been. And I'm just going to throw in that little quote for posterity.
Oh, some great stuff. I'm going to have to go reread it again just to find all that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, anything else, Dennis?
No, I think, you know, we've been going on here for a little bit of probably over an hour here, and I know Jorge's there on the East Coast, so it's kind of getting a little late for him. So we appreciate your time. Yeah, we appreciate your time tonight. Really, really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thanks for having us on. We really appreciate it.
So the book is Spencer and Locke. If you've not read it, trust me, you need to read this. You really need to read this. Available from Action Lab. And again, as Dennis mentioned, for everybody who tweets the show, and that's at BOTR Comics, this comes out. We're going to take it. If you tweet us and mention Spencer and Locke, we're going to throw all those names into a hat and draw two out for copies, the trade paperback. And if you live in the Los Angeles area, David said he would try to sign it.
I will gladly sign it. And if you're in Atlanta, you can find Jorge.
Yeah.
Very good. If you want to reach either Dennis or I am at JForgets on Twitter.
And I'm at Utenger, UTENGR.
So thanks again, gentlemen. We certainly appreciate the time.
Thank you. We appreciate it.